and election had triggered the revolution of 2004. With the electorate split between East and West, in 2010 it was Yanukovych who won a narrow majority, fair and square. Yanukovych was a corrupt manipulator who tacked back and forth between the West and Russia. He took funds from the IMF. He continued negotiations with the EU. He imprisoned Tymoshenko on corruption charges and used her as a pawn. At the same time, he dallied with Putin and his Eurasian bloc. As his clan enriched itself, his popularity drained and foreign exchange reserves dwindled. On the occasion of the next elections, which he had little hope of winning, it seems that he was preparing the security forces for a showdown. But the 2014 election was not the only deadline. Already in 2013, negotiations with the EU and the Russians had reached a point that forced Kiev to a decision that would depend, among other things, on the shifting international financial climate. Up to the spring of 2013, under the impulse of the Fed's quantitative easing, dollars flowed even to Ukraine. On April 10, 2013, Kiev turned down the latest offer from the IMF to help finance its gaping current account deficit and instead launched a 1.25 billion euro-dollar bond issue, which was eagerly taken up by the markets at the comparatively modest interest rate of 7.5%. But then Bernanke's taper pronouncement of May 22 hit the markets. Interest rates surged to 10%. Searching for alternative sources of funding and personal enrichment, Yanukovych canvassed the world for options. He explored shale gas development with Shell and Chevron. In the fall of 2013, a deal was on the books to lease to China an enormous holding of 7.5 million acres of prime farmland, 5% of the entire land mass of Ukraine, 10% of its arable land, an area the size of Belgium. China was not just after Lebensraum. It was also offering to put $10 billion into port facilities in Crimea. But it was the talks with the EU that were pivotal. The promise that Yanukovych had made to the Ukrainian population was the promise of Europe. Ukraine's officially sponsored media were talking up the association agreement as a prelude to full membership. The EU gave no indication that that was likely, but it did nothing to deflate expectations. Western press sources billed the Vilnius summit quite openly as the climax of a six-year campaign to lure Ukraine into integration with the EU and out of the Kremlin's orbit. The threat was not lost on Russia, and its threats of sanctions mattered. 25% of Ukraine's exports went to the EU, but 26% went to Russia, and much of the rest went to CIS states within Putin's reach. In early September, Yanukovych was still browbeating reluctant pro-Russian members of his party to accept the Western deal. What was not clear, until Kiev received the IMF's letter of November 20, 2013, was quite how unattractive the Western terms would be. The IMF offered Ukraine only $5 billion and noted that it would be expected to use $3.7 billion of it to repay the 2008 loan due in 2014. No one in Kiev had reason to expect generosity from the IMF, but the EU's offer came as a real shock. A committee of German experts had estimated that Ukraine would stand to lose at least $3 billion per annum in trade with Russia due to sanctions. In Kiev, the estimated loss had been inflated to something closer to $50 billion. Brussels swept all these figures aside. In conjunction with the association agreement, all that the EU was willing to offer was 610 million euros. In exchange, the IMF demanded big budget cuts, a 40% increase in natural gas bills, and a 25% devaluation. It was anything but the pot of gold that Yanukovych had promised. There were Ukrainian oligarchs with personal fortunes larger than this. Even without considering the sanctions to be expected from Russia, to have accepted such a deal would have been a political disaster. In Kiev, there was outrage. "We could not contain our emotions. It was unacceptable," Ukraine's permanent representative for NATO told Reuters. "When his country turned to Europe for help, they spat on us. We are apparently not Poland. Apparently, we are not on a level with Poland. They're not letting us in, really. We will be standing at the doors. We're nice, but we're not Poles. Fortunately for Kiev, or so it seemed, Moscow had an alternative plan. On November 21st, 2013, Putin offered, and Yanukovych accepted, a gas contract on concessionary terms and a $15 billion loan. The condition was that Ukraine, like Armenia, would join the Eurasian Customs Union. In light of subsequent events, Yanukovych's decision would come to be seen as the Pavlovian response of a pro-Moscow stooge. It was quite possible that he was subject to Russian blackmail. But setting such rumours aside, his choice was hardly inexplicable. As Ukraine's Prime Minister, Mykola Azarov, explained, the extremely harsh conditions of the EU-IMF package had decided the issue. Nor was this logic hidden from the Europeans in the immediate aftermath of the debacle. On November 28, 2013, speaking to Der Spiegel, European Parliament President Martin Schulz admitted that EU officials made mistakes in their negotiations with Ukraine. I think we underestimated the drama of the domestic political situation in Ukraine. Ukraine, he said, had been in a deep economic and financial crisis since the introduction of democracy. They desperately need money, and they desperately need a reliable gas supply. Schulz said he understood why Ukraine moved toward Russia. It is not especially popular in Europe to help states which are in a crisis, and if you look at Moscow's proposals, they would offer Ukraine short-term assistance that we as Europeans cannot and do not want to afford. What no one reckoned with, not Yanukovych, the Russians, or the EU, was the reaction of a vocal and bold minority among the Ukrainian population. The opinion poll evidence does not suggest that there was an overwhelming majority for a decisive shift toward the EU. According to Kiev's International Institute of Sociology, in November 2013, only 39% of respondents favoured association with the EU, barely 2% more than the 37% who favoured a Russian-led customs union. And those numbers were based on a hypothetical, not the stern terms offered by the IMF and the EU. But events in Ukraine in 2013 were not decided by a referendum on the basis of clearly costed alternatives. They were driven by enthusiastic, fired-up minorities, inspired by hopes and fears of Russia and Western Europe, and an eclectic range of political imagery drawn from every part of the political spectrum. In November and December, hundreds of thousands of people rallied to Kiev's freezing streets to protest Yanukovych's abrupt decision to reject the association agreement. But they made no overthrow attempt, and Yanukovych might have ridden out the storm, but for the ill-advised decision, encouraged by Moscow, to crack down. By using his majority in parliament to ram through constitutional changes, on January 16th he triggered a second wave of mass protests and the occupation of government buildings across Ukraine. At this point, the involvement of the EU and the United States became overt. Quite how deeply Washington was engaged was revealed by the infamous bugged conversation between Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, and the US Ambassador to Ukraine, which is as illuminating in its characterization of US-EU relations at this point as it was in its blunt instrumentalization of Ukraine's politicians. On January 28, 2014, as Nuland discussed options with Ambassador Pyatt, she casually remarked, "That will be great, I think, to help glue this thing, and have the UN glue it, and, you know, fuck the EU." For Nuland's taste, the EU was too slow-moving and too willing to compromise with President Yanukovych, with whom it had been eagerly pursuing a comprehensive association agreement only a few months earlier. Without flinching, Ambassador Pyatt replied, "We've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it." 2 weeks later, a desperate last stand in the streets of Kiev brought an end to Yanukovych's presidency. On February 21st, in talks that were brokered by the foreign ministers of Germany, France, and Poland, and witnessed by Putin's representative on the spot, Yanukovych was offered the protection of his office until new presidential elections were held at the end of 2014. But as support from within his party and the security forces melted away, he thought better of taking the risk. He too remembered Gaddafi's fate. Early in the morning on February 22nd, he fled, leaving a vacuum. Short-circuiting constitutional procedures, a new provisional government took office, pending elections scheduled for May 25th. What the EU had intended as a protracted transition had become a revolutionary overthrow. And rather than waiting for the outcome of the election, the provisional government, dominated by Timoshenko's Fatherland Party and a sprinkling of Maidan activists, moved rapidly to consolidate the new dispensation. It would reverse Yanukovych's abrupt decision of November. It would draw a clean line with Russia, sign the European Association Agreement, and conclude new financial agreements, not with Russia, but with the IMF and the European Union. How was Moscow to react? The choice at Vilnius in November 2013 had been pitched by both sides as a strategic turning point. Thanks to the niggardliness of the IMF-EU offer, Moscow had won a significant victory, only for that to be overturned by popular protest and regime change, which, even if it had the support of a considerable fraction of the Ukrainian people, was of dubious legality and was undeniably Western-inspired. For Russia to have meekly accepted this outcome would have been worse than if Yanukovych had signed the association agreement in the first place. On the night of February 22nd to 23rd, the Kremlin decided to act. Taking advantage of local protests and activating plans prepared in 2008 to counter a fast-track NATO application, on February 27th, 2014, Russian troops in perfunctory disguises seized control of the Crimean Peninsula. A few days later, to further ramp up the pressure on Kiev, Russia put its muscle behind a separatist uprising in the eastern region of Donetsk. The comprehensive economic, political, and diplomatic clash between the West and Russia that had been foreshadowed in the proxy war in Georgia in 2008 was now unleashed on an altogether more significant stage. With Ukraine's territorial integrity at stake, on April 13, 2014, the provisional government in Kiev launched an anti-terrorist operation to take back control of the Donbass. In Washington and at NATO headquarters, there were those calling for immediate military aid for Kiev and a full-throated return to the Cold War. McCain and other Republican hawks would have loved to have rallied a war party. Doing so, perhaps, might have contributed to restoring coherence to their troubled party. But as he had done in Syria in 2013, Obama refused the call to escalate. In Europe, there was no support for military action. It was not that Ukraine would be denied weapons, but as in Syria, the arms would be supplied through covert channels. The public front of the West's reaction was economic sanctions. Putin's line had always been that geoeconomics were geopolitics. In Ukraine, struggles over trade negotiations and customs treaties had escalated into an undeclared war. Now, the economy itself would be weaponized. Or would it? To pressurize Iran, the United States had developed a ferociously effective regime of sanctions. Russia, as a globally integrated economy, was far more vulnerable. Not only did Russian businesses need to export, but they had sucked deeply at the trough of cheap dollar credit. By early 2014, they owed $728 billion. But by the same token, large vested interests in the West were at stake. Apart from anything else, Russia was the number two supplier of oil and gas exports to world markets. At a time of extreme fragility in the emerging market economies, the United States did not want to precipitate further tension in commodity markets. To the frustration of the hardliners, for the United States stayed its hands and never applied the full force of its sanctions weapon. Instead, it targeted individual members of the clique close to Putin, the most prominent of whom was Igor Sechin, the boss of oil giant Rosneft. Furthermore, Washington limited access to capital markets for key corporations, Rosneft, Novatek, Gazprom Bank, and VEB. This was painful, but given the limited volume of U.S.-Russian economic relations, it was far from decisive. The crucial question was whether Europe would throw its weight behind America's sanctions. Russia-EU trade was 10 times larger than Russia-US trade. The EU received 41% of all Russia's exports. This gave the EU considerable leverage, but it also meant it had more to lose. German corporate leaders and senior politicians, such as ex-Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, continued to cultivate friendly relations with Putin, even as Russia's troops made incursions into Ukraine. France had 2 big aircraft carriers on order from Russia. Italy's energy corporations were deeply entangled in Black Sea projects. London, the playground of the oligarchs, was the place to make sanctions tell. The Cameron government talked a good game, but was less quick to act. Nor was it merely economic interests that were at stake. In Germany, there was deep skepticism about any overhasty alignment with the United States. Since the summer of 2013, the NSA spying scandal had cast a deep shadow over German-US relations. A year later, the percentage of Germans who saw the United States as a trustworthy partner was down to 38%, numbers last seen in the Bush era. Whereas 68% of Americans favored extending NATO to Ukraine, 67% of Germans were against it. Likewise, 63% of Germans rejected EU membership for Ukraine. To the indignation of right-wingers in Congress, all that the EU could agree to were individualized sanctions against 18 leading Russian figures. Senator John McCain was moved to declare, "If the Europeans decide that the economic considerations are too important to impose severe sanctions on Vladimir Putin, then they are ignoring the lessons of history." Appeasement had failed against Hitler in 1938. It would fail against Mr. Putin. In May, transatlantic tensions were mounting to such a pitch that Merkel and Obama hastily convened talks in the White House. Merkel had no doubt about the need for action, but she could not ignore European public opinion, and McCain's outbursts were not helpful. The two agreed that Obama would restrain the American hawks, while Merkel moved to build a consensus in Europe around tougher measures. In the meantime, if no military aid was forthcoming and only minimal sanctions were applied to Russia, would the West at least provide generous financial support to Ukraine? Just to meet its outstanding obligations, the new government in Kiev estimated that it needed $35 billion over 2 years. That was not far off the estimates presented by Yanukovych's regime 6 months earlier, which had been rejected out of hand. In March 2014, Kiev put in a request for $15 billion from the IMF. The Obama administration backed the appeal and sought to leverage it to break the deadlock in Congress over IMF reform. The administration linked a $1 billion loan guarantee for Ukraine that was popular with the Republican right wing to a proposal to unblock IMF funding. The Ukraine crisis was a clear demonstration, the White House insisted, of the IMF's strategic importance to the United States. Globalist critics of the IMF pounced on the pronouncement. The subservience of the IMF as a tool of U.S. policy stood starkly revealed. Except that the Republicans in Congress did not agree. They cut out the IMF funding proposal. Lagarde and the IMF soldiered on without America's full backing. For a well-run country at peace and with the institutions to make the most of its ample endowments, Ukraine's debt burden would have been far from excessive. But Ukraine was none of those things. Given the huge political uncertainty, the insecurity produced by Russian intervention, and its weak institutions, there was, in fact, a strong case to be made that Ukraine's debts were insupportable. Ukraine was insolvent, and its debt should be written down. That would have been the IMF protocol. But Ukraine was no ordinary case. In 2010, Greece had been funded under the systemic exemption. The risk of financial contagion justified an unsustainable bailout. In April 2014, in Ukraine, systemic risk was recast in geopolitical terms. The IMF's main shareholders did not want to see the embattled pro-Western regime in Kiev declared bankrupt within weeks of an anti-Putin revolution. So despite the obvious risks and despite Ukraine's appalling track record of program compliance, the IMF plunged in once again. out of enthusiastic talk of reform and over-optimistic assumptions about economic recovery, the IMF concocted a scenario that allowed it to lend Ukraine $17 billion over 2 years. A further 11 billion euros would come from the EU and $1 billion in loan guarantees from the United States. Japan chipped in too. In addition, the EU agreed to take 98% of Ukraine's exports tariff-free. Visa-free travel was envisioned for 2015. For the winter, the EU promised to backstop Ukraine's energy supplies by providing a flow of gas through Slovakia, Poland, and Hungary. It was a substantial commitment, but it fell well short of what Ukraine needed. The aid from Europe would be stretched over 7 years. The IMF loan, as always, came with tough conditions. Gas prices were to be raised by 56%, and the government payroll cut by 10%. The foreign exchanges were to be liberalized to allow the exchange rate to adjust to a competitive level, a high-risk operation that was likely to put huge pressure on Ukraine's banks. The largest risk of all were the military operations in eastern Ukraine. The IMF had never previously lent to a country at war, so in putting together the April 2014 package, the fund simply ignored the evidence of the escalating conflict. As Lagarde admitted in a press statement, this put the entire program in jeopardy from the start. Within days of the conclusion of the financial package, it became clear that Ukraine did indeed face the worst-case scenario. Rather than calming, the conflict in eastern Ukraine intensified. In early May, scrambling to raise an army, Kiev was forced to reintroduce conscription. As the oligarch Petro Poroshenko took office as Ukraine's president in the last week of May 2014, he faced the impossible challenge of implementing an IMF austerity program while fighting a war. A war, moreover, that Russia would not let Ukraine win. Kiev's only hope was that while military escalation placed an ever greater stress on Ukraine's fragile economy, it would also clarify the political stakes of the conflict and suck in the West. In July, a vigorous offensive by Ukraine's forces was on the point of overwhelming the Donbas rebels. Moscow's response was to resupply the breakaway militia with heavy weapons. A conflict of small-scale skirmishes was escalating into a more or less openly declared war involving the mobilization of tens of thousands of men, mass displacement, and thousands of casualties. On July 17th, a rebel anti-aircraft battery armed with new Russian missiles jubilantly reported that they had shot down a heavy transport plane. It turned out to be Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, with 298 passengers and crew on board. It was the moral indignation in the aftermath of that outrage that enabled Merkel to push through a much stronger sanctions regime. The EU blocked the export to Russia of any military equipment, oil industry equipment, and the issuance of long-term debt in the EU by Russia's state-owned banks and energy corporations. The United States doubled down by restricting access to capital markets for Sberbank and pressuring ExxonMobil and BP to drop their collaborations with Russian energy partners. But the real thrust of 21st-century sanctions was financial. By September 2014, Rosneft, Transneft, Gazprom, Novatek, Sberbank, VTB, Gazprom Bank, and Bank of Moscow, along with arms makers United Aircraft Corporation and Kalashnikov, were all locked out of Western financial markets. Two of the banks most closely linked to Putin and his entourage had hundreds of millions of dollars frozen in U.S. accounts. Moscow, for its part, resorted to more classic retaliation. It did not cut off gas supplies, but it issued a blanket ban against agricultural imports from Europe while increasing its military support for the Donbas rebels, who mounted a bloody counteroffensive on August 23rd to 24th. With a front line frozen, Kiev was forced to accept a ceasefire brokered in Minsk by Germany and France on September 5th. With the new Cold War between Russia and the West having escalated into a comprehensive and violent confrontation, it now came down to a trial of strength. Since the shock of 2008, Russia's official financial position had been rebuilt. In early 2014, Moscow's foreign currency reserves stood at $510 billion. As in 2008, it was not the state, but Russia's globalized private sector that was vulnerable. Though the oligarchs, of course, towed Putin's line, the markets did not lie. The escalation of tensions over Ukraine caused an immediate capital outflow. When the Russian Federation Council on Saturday, March 1, 2014, gave a patriotic vote of approval for the deployment of Russian troops on Ukrainian territory, it was followed on Black Monday, March 3, by a spectacular 11-12% market slump. For internationalized Russian banks like Sberbank, a giant that controlled 28% of Russian bank assets, sanctions created a truly schizophrenic situation. As its CEO, Hermann Greff, mused, 50% of Sberbank's freely marketable shares were held by US and British investors, but the bank was now barred from raising funds in the West. Perforce, over the course of 2014, Russian companies paid down their foreign debt from $729 billion to $599 billion, with the central bank deploying its reserves to enable the repayment. Tension was building, but it was not until autumn that the crisis broke. The third round of sanctions, in the wake of the downing of MH17, bit deep. At the same moment, Janet Yellen's Fed finally ended QE3, tightening credit conditions around the world. And then cooperation in OPEC broke down. Saudi Arabia ended its production restraint, and oil prices collapsed. With or without sanctions, by the autumn of 2014, Russia would have been in serious financial difficulty. The combination of sanctions, Fed monetary tightening, and a plunge in commodity prices was devastating. So devastating, in fact, that it has raised the question of whether this conjunction was entirely coincidental, or whether the United States and the Saudis were collaborating to launch a strike against Russia. Oil politics are a rich field for conspiracy theory. There certainly are back channels between Washington and Riyadh. Secretary of State Kerry was in the Gulf in the fall of 2014. The Saudis had every reason to act, if not over Ukraine, then over Syria. Along with Iran, Russia was the main backer of Assad's die-hard regime. Saudi Arabia was its sworn enemy. There is no conclusive proof, nor is a conspiracy necessary to explain these concurrent events. The oil market was under stress. America's new fracking technology had opened up a new source of supply that was cheap and highly elastic. From the point of view of the Russian economy, in any case, the ultimate motivation was irrelevant. Oil prices plunged from $112 per barrel in June to around $60 per barrel by December 2014. And kept on falling. On top of sanctions and tightening credit conditions, it was a body blow. In October, the Russian Central Bank intervened heavily to prevent an immediate ruble collapse, but it needed to husband its reserves, and in November, it exited the market. Starting at 33 to the dollar before the Ukraine crisis began, by December 1, 2014, the ruble had fallen to 49 against the dollar. This was terrifying for Russian corporate borrowers, who owed $35 billion in debt repayments by the end of the year. There was a scramble for survival. Rosneft, which had $10 billion to pay, was in the market hoovering up euros and dollars. The strain on weaker Russian businesses was unbearable. In December, Trust Bank, a high street lender, and UT Air, Russia's third largest airline, failed, and the central bank was forced to offer guarantees for the entire banking sector. On the morning of Monday, December 15th, the ruble began to plunge, ending the day down by 8%. That night, after a long evening of debate involving Putin himself, the central bank decided that it would hike interest rates from 6.5% to 17%. The announcement was made at 1 a.m. It was intended to reassure investors and punish speculators. It didn't work. It was read not as reassurance, but as a sign of panic. As markets opened on the morning of Russia's Black Tuesday, December 16th, the foreign exchange market went into freefall. By the end of the day, the ruble had fallen to 80 against the dollar. The following day, Sberbank came under concerted attack. 1 million of its customers received text messages from addresses outside Russia, warning that the bank was about to be cut off altogether from external liquidity. On December 18th, $6 billion were withdrawn. Over the following week, the total came to $20 billion. It was a spectacular bank run, even by the standards of 2007 to 2008. The oligarchs were once again exposed. Estimates vary, but the combination of the Ukraine imbroglio, the oil price shock, and the December 2014 turmoil cost the 20 richest Russians between $62 billion and $73.4 billion. Once again, Putin called in favors and demanded action. Measures were passed calling for the end to the offshore hoarding of wealth. An amnesty was offered to those who would bring their cash home. Meanwhile, the central bank attempted to get a grip on the situation with an increase in deposit insurance and the recapitalization of ailing banks. President Putin called for the authorities to abandon general principles of policy. They would need to be in manual override to see the country through. But there was one general principle that would not be abandoned. Russia did not want to ruin its reputation in the eyes of foreign investors by resorting to capital controls. Instead, to provide the necessary foreign exchange, the central bank ran down its reserves, which dipped as low as $388.5 billion on December 26th. This cushioned the collapse of the ruble, but the pressure continued. The Western ratings agencies started by downgrading Gazprom. In January, they lowered the rating of Rosneft, Transneft, and Lukoil. Then the ruble slumped by 7%, giving up much of the ground it had recovered since the end of 2014. That, in turn, posed the question of the central bank's reserves. What Russia was struggling to contain was something akin to the bank-sovereign doom loop that had menaced the eurozone until 2012. But what was now at stake was not just financial solvency, but victory in a geopolitical tug of war. In his first period as president, Putin's legitimacy had been based in large part on a sustained recovery in living standards. That easy narrative was broken by the crisis of 2008. From 2014 onward, economic expectations were further diminished. Over the winter of 2014 to 2015, GDP was falling by more than 10% per annum. It would not stabilize until the second half of 2015. For ordinary Russians, the crisis of 2014 to 2015 was considerably worse than that of 2008 to 2009. Real wages fell more sharply and rebounded less vigorously. The Russia that emerged from the Ukraine clash was above all a nationalist regime whose citizens were called upon to pay whatever price was necessary for their nation's re-emergence on the global stage. It was tough, but it was a role that came easily. And indeed, in some respects, one might even say it was convenient. As Prime Minister during the 2008 crisis, Putin had thrown himself into hands-on domestic crisis fighting. Since his return to the presidency in 2012, the Kremlin had been inciting nationalism to offset disappointing economic growth and disappointing poll ratings. Given the collapse in oil prices in 2014 to 2015, some campaign of nationalist incitement was only to be expected. The crisis in Ukraine was perfectly timed. Even with the economy languishing, Putin's personal popularity surged from a low in 2013 in the mid-40s to a record 89% approval in June 2015. Russia suffered, but if the economy was a weapon, it cut both ways. You could not damage Russia without damaging its neighbors. The much-feared emerging market crisis hit the post-Soviet world with a vengeance. Between the end of 2013 and early 2015, the currencies of Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Belarus devalued by 50% against the dollar. The Kyrgyz, Moldovan, and Tajik currencies lost between 30 and 35% of their value. Across Central Asia, the effect was to force sudden and sharp increases in interest rates and to place enormous pressure on the balance sheets of those banks and businesses that had globalized and borrowed abroad. Meanwhile, Family incomes were squeezed as remittances from migrant workers in Russia plunged. In Tajikistan, the most remittance-dependent country of the world, where approximately one half of its working-age males earned their living in Russia, it threatened a catastrophic fall in household income and foreign exchange earnings. Kyrgyzstan, the world's second most remittance-dependent country, was also badly affected. But if the crisis took its toll on the entire region, the epicenter of the shock was Ukraine. In the emergency bailout of April 2014, the IMF had started its estimate of Ukraine's economic situation from an exchange rate of 12.5 hryvnia to the dollar. The IMF had called on Kiev to impose currency controls to prevent capital flight, while letting its currency float and allowing domestic prices to adjust to whatever level would ensure the viability of government-owned gas firms. If this program had been adopted, it would have squeezed both ordinary Ukrainians and wealthy Ukrainians, who would see their funds trapped in a depreciating currency. Instead, the Ukrainian Central Bank did the reverse. It permitted billions of dollars to flee the Ukrainian banking system while using its precious exchange reserves to stem the decline in the exchange rate. While prices surged by 50%, the result was to favor the most wealthy Ukrainians, who swapped their assets into dollars at favorable exchange rates. All told, $8 billion drained from the currency reserves. Whatever money was pumped into Ukraine simply bled out. With exchange reserves depleted to as little as $4.7 billion by February 2015, the central bank finally abandoned the exchange rate. As the European powers struggled to make diplomacy work, and the hawks in Washington and at NATO headquarters were urging ramped-up military support, between February 5th and February 6th, the currency plunged by 50% in 24 hours. Prices were adjusted on a daily basis, and to combat hoarding, a system of de facto rationing was introduced, which limited each consumer to buying fixed quantities of flour, oil, rice, and buckwheat. Meanwhile, GDP fell by almost 18% year-on-year, making Ukraine's debts progressively less and less sustainable. With the battle in the Donbass ongoing, the government of the Revolution of 2014, like its predecessor in 2004, was seeing its legitimacy evaporate in the face of insurmountable economic problems. To enable the new Ukrainian regime to survive, in the spring of 2015, there was no alternative to further foreign assistance. On March 11, 2015, the IMF recommitted itself to Ukraine, relaunching the agreement of the previous year, this time rated at $17.5 billion. It would be the cornerstone of a $40 billion four-year deal supported by the EU. But this time, at last, the IMF acknowledged that there would have to be debt restructuring. In 2014, the comprehensive crisis, both geopolitical and financial, that had threatened the post-Soviet sphere in 2008 had arrived, and the verdict it delivered on the hegemony of the United States and its alliance system was ambiguous, to say the least. A popular upheaval had swung Ukraine forcibly toward Europe. The association agreement, eagerly signed by President Poroshenko in June 2014, was finally ratified in July 2017. The West had not let Ukraine sink. But neither had it saved it from crisis. Ukraine's financial position remained precarious. The debt restructuring deal that was eventually done in August 2015 satisfied the IMF's demand for private sector involvement in formal terms, but in fact, it imposed minimal losses on the hedge funds that had gobbled up Ukraine's distressed debt. It bought Ukraine only the slightest amount of debt relief, cutting its debts from $71 billion to $67 billion, while Ukraine's GDP continued to plunge. The viability of the package would depend on the unpredictable course of domestic reform and the intensity of the confrontation with Russia, which neither the United States nor Europe had mustered the resources or political will to decisively repel. As far as Russia was concerned, even in combination with the oil price shock, the sanctions were painful, but not decisive. By the spring of 2015, Putin's regime had regained its grip. If and when oil prices began to stabilize, Moscow's position would recover. Sanctions would soon prove deeply unpopular within the EU. To general amazement, Russia would find prominent sympathizers, even in the United States. While it bided its time, Moscow could cause trouble in the Middle East, it could fish in troubled waters in the United States, and it could look for new strategic partners farther afield. In the Cold War, the interplay among Washington, Beijing, and Moscow had been crucial in shifting the balance of power. In principle, a resurgent China could pick and choose. It had no particular reason to prefer Putin. But in the spring of 2014, in the East Asian arena, tensions between Japan and China were rising to a dangerous level. Washington gave notice that it meant to stand behind its strategic pivot. It would not countenance China's assertion of rights in the South China Sea. But for America to take a strong line in Asia, while at the same time confronting Russia in Europe, had its price. It offered Russia an opportunity, and Putin seized it. In the spring of 2014, as the seriousness of Russia's confrontation with the West became clear, the Moscow leadership resolved on a strategic approach to China. China would provide Russia with support against the West. If the United States and the EU were determined to oppose Russia in economic terms, it would find markets in China and sources of capital in Shanghai and Hong Kong. China, for its part facing resistance in the South China Sea, could build a Eurasian land route via Russia and Central Europe. The EU had shown no interest in joining America's de facto containment alliance in Asia. Russia would provide the bridge. A start was made in May 2014 with the signing of a $400 billion 30-year Sino-Russian gas deal. Though the strategic logic was strong, in practice, Moscow found that doing business with China was fraught with difficulty. The Chinese were tough negotiators. Russia's hard-pressed oligarchs were reluctant to commit to long-term deals when they were not negotiating from a position of strength. Laying the necessary infrastructure eastward was monumentally expensive, and Russia's elite were leery of opening up Siberia to ever greater Chinese influence. Gas diplomacy, in an age in which prices for fossil fuels were gyrating, was a volatile business. But for both Moscow and Beijing, the point went beyond economics. It was about redefining the balance of power and affirming multipolarity. It would not be the incumbent hegemon that would shape the 21st century order, but the rising power of Asia and its allies. In so doing, Moscow and Beijing were also giving a new ending to the 20th century. The symbolism of guest lists at the anniversary celebrations for victory in World War II in 2015 was hard to ignore. 70 years after that struggle, in which China, Russia, the United States, Britain, and France had been united against the Axis, a new relationship was being constructed between China and Russia, a relationship that had the potential to reshape Eurasia. In Moscow on May 9th and Beijing on September 3rd, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin were each other's guests of honor at spectacular commemorative ceremonies. Obama, Cameron, Hollande, and Merkel gave their excuses. In the spring of 2015, the one Western leader who would look to the former allies of World War II for support would be the embattled left-wing Prime Minister of Greece. Chapter 22 Hashtag This Is a Coup. In the Maidan demonstrations of the winter of 2013 to 2014, Ukrainians enthusiastically waved the blue banner of the EU. After the grinding battles of the Eurozone, it was something of a relief for Europe to be celebrated by anyone, anywhere. The pro-EU demonstrators in Kiev hailed Europe as the future. To them it offered the promise of democracy, freedom, prosperity, the rule of law, the good Europe. It was an image that stemmed from the era of the 1990s and early 2000s, when Europe had celebrated the end of the Cold War, economic growth, and the prospect of ever closer union. For some pundits in both Europe and the United States, the clash with Putin was an occasion to reaffirm that vision against outside threat. But the question in the wake of the Eurozone crises of 2008 to 2012 was whether the main threat to the good Europe in fact came from without or from within. Anxiously watched by the rest of the world, the 2012 stabilization of the Eurozone had been based on a compromise among Germany, Italy, Spain, France, and the rest. It was driven by the fear of an escalation that would take down first Spain and then Italy. A year later, the acute phase of the crisis had passed, but as the second recession to hit Europe in short succession began to make itself fully felt, the EU entered a new season of discontent. The Eurozone's stabilization in 2012 was conditioned on the expectation of further forward movement. That was the program with which the European Council of June 28 to 29 had addressed the Spanish crisis. It was the message that Draghi had delivered in London. The fiscal compact, the banking union, the development of the ESM and the ECB's OMT were major steps toward the consolidation of the Eurozone. The question, as ever, was whether they were sufficient, and whether the EU had the will to move at the requisite speed. On the banking union, everything remained to be done, and Berlin was in no hurry to sign up to a common resolution fund until the full extent of the damage in southern Europe was uncovered. Germany and France were bitterly divided over the banking crisis that exploded in Cyprus in 2013. Meanwhile, Merkel had her own reform agenda. Not satisfied with having transferred the Schuldenbremse to Europe, she wanted to push the German vision of labour market reform to the European level as well. In 2013, her mantra was competitiveness and unit labour costs. For this, too, as for budget discipline, Germany wanted contracts and rules. Merkel's authority in the wake of the Eurozone crisis was remarkable, and Germany was the most comfortably situated of Europe's economies. Labour markets were tight, and global demand for Germany's exports was booming. Even if exports to the rest of Europe were flat, Germans had little reason to doubt the narrative of their own national success. But even in this cocoon of prosperity, German politics were not immune to stress. The weak link was the FDP, Merkel's chosen coalition partner since 2009. The FDP's pro-business, tax-cutting agenda had no more than niche appeal in Germany at the best of times. Its national sovereignist position came increasingly under pressure in the course of the Eurozone crisis. It would have made a good basis for opposition. Inside a government constantly forced to make compromises to hold the Eurozone together, the FDP was playing a losing hand. The indignation aroused in Germany in 2012 by talk of Eurobonds, the further round of assistance for Greece, and Draghi's activism heightened the party's political difficulties. And these became acute in the spring of 2013, with the emergence of the first overtly Eurosceptic party in modern German politics, the Alternative für Deutschland. Though in 2015 it would go on to lead the campaign against Merkel's refugee policy, gathering a nativist electorate around it, the AfD was originally founded by a group of conservative professors opposed to Merkel's compromising policy on the Eurozone. In the German general election of September 2013, to the relief of the mainstream, the AfD failed to break through the 5% hurdle required to enter the Bundestag. But it took enough of the FDP's votes to drop them out of Parliament for the first time since 1949. On the back of a much-increased vote for the CDU, Merkel would become Chancellor for a third time, once more in coalition with the SPD. Despite coming in second, the SPD drove a hard bargain and claimed a remarkable share of the key cabinet portfolios. But the Grand Coalition gave Merkel a broad parliamentary base, and the most vital element of continuity was provided by Wolfgang Schäuble, who continued as finance minister. In September 2014, Schäuble announced to the Bundestag the joyous news that for the first time since 1969, he would be budgeting for zero new debt. In a world shaken by the violence in Ukraine, Syria, and Iraq, and terrified by the Ebola epidemic, he declared, Germany's robust financial position would send a message of confidence. The program of the debt break on which Germany had embarked in 2009 was being realized ahead of time. The rest of the Eurozone had more immediate worries. In both economic and political terms, the pressure was relentless. The crisis fighting of 2012 had stopped the immediate catastrophe, but the shocks to confidence delivered between 2011 and 2012 sucked the Eurozone economy down, and the straitjacket of fiscal consolidation squeezed tightly. The deep recession did not begin to ease until the second half of 2013. By that point, unemployment in Greece and Spain had peaked at 26 to 27%. When it came, recovery was agonizingly slow and was overshadowed by the increasingly worrying news from the emerging markets. In 2014, with prices falling all around the world economy, the EU was stalked by the fear of deflation. Was the EU sliding toward the economic quicksand that had trapped Japan since the 1990s, with bad debts weighing on recovery and inadequate demand feeding on itself? How could Europe respond? The fiscal compact constrained government spending even on much-needed investment. In Spain, which was undergoing one of the most severe adjustments, public spending both on infrastructure and education was slashed. But net of depreciation, it was Germany that had some of the lowest levels of public investment in Europe. Would the ECB finally make good on its promise to do whatever it takes? Draghi cut rates, but would the ECB go a step further and embark on QE? As inflation slid toward zero and expectations moved into negative territory, the economic case for action by the ECB was serious. But with nationalist resentment on the rise in Germany and the Bundesbank still smarting from its defeat in 2012, so too were the political risks. While economists and politicians argued over policy options, a large segment of Europe's population had simply had enough. Across Europe, opinion polls showed a sharp decline in support for the EU, even in states that had historically been overwhelmingly favourable. And then came the EU's parliamentary elections of May 2014. The results rocked the European political establishment. Eurosceptic nationalist parties made dramatic gains. UKIP won in Britain. More significantly, the National Front, FN, won in France, taking 25% of the vote, as compared with the middle-of-the-road conservative UMP with 20%, and the ruling Parti Socialiste with 14.7%. The FN drew on France's deep strain of nationalism, anti-Semitism, and post-colonial racism. But since January 2011, Marine Le Pen had run a campaign to de-demonize the party, refashioning it as a vehicle for popular nationalism pitched against globalization and the EU. To its petit bourgeois base, the FN added a large part of what would once have been thought of as the constituency of the left, blue-collar and unemployed voters. When the FN's voters were asked ahead of the May 2014 election what mattered to them, they mentioned three things. For 63%, immigration was a top priority. A similar number raised economic issues. But hostility to the EU came top of the list. 83% of FN voters were persuaded that belonging to the EU had aggravated the effects of the economic crisis on France. 81% thought that the economic policy of the current government, conforming to the demands of austerity, would likely fail. Given the experience of Europe since 2008, one could hardly say that these were unreasonable opinions. Two-thirds of FN voters drew the conclusion that France should leave the euro. The pool of right-wing nationalist resentment on the margin of European politics was not new, though it gained new adherence and far greater credibility in light of the disastrous mishandling of the crisis. What was new was the mobilization on the left. By contrast with the FN's furious, lower-class, poorly educated base, the new parties of the left were updated and energized iterations of the kind of progressive social movement that Europe had repeatedly seen since the late 1960s. In Spain, Podemos was an offspring of M15, an imaginative, broad-based social movement headed by a university teacher with an electorate that had a larger percentage of university graduates than any other political force in Spain. Syriza had the most balanced representation of upper, middle, and lower-class groups of any party in Greece. What drove the surge in support for the left from 2008 was not fundamentalist opposition, so much as the sense that the EU was betraying Europe's own promise. The immediate reaction of mainstream media to the May 2014 result was to dismiss both left- and right-wing critics of the status quo as populist. The impatience and irrationality of the parties of protest would undo the good work of fiscal consolidation done since 2010. They were splitting Europe at a moment when it needed to stand united against the new threats on its borders. There were dark rumours of Russian infiltration. That was alarming, no doubt. But in 2014, a new Cold War was among the more reassuring scenarios on offer. What if Europe was marching back not to the 1950s, but to the 1930s? Was the script not hauntingly familiar? A financial crisis met with obstinate austerity led to mass unemployment and political radicalization. When melded with fears of Putin's meddling and terror attacks by radical Islamists, memories of Europe's dark history could easily be stewed into a terrifying image of a new dark continent. In perhaps the most dramatic manifestation of this apocalyptic brand of Euroscepticism, in March 2015, the widely read American monthly Atlantic posed the question, "Is it time for the Jews to leave Europe?" Influential journalist Jeffrey Goldberg constructed for his American audience a narrative in which disaffected, unemployed Islamic youth, festering in Europe's run-down housing projects and inner cities, were entangled with the continent's deep-rooted anti-Semitic history and the rise of a new right. When asked in the accompanying video what the last European Jew should do on departing the old world, Leon Wieseltier commented simply, "Spit." The fear and vitriol this expressed fed off memories that went back to the Holocaust and long before. What is striking is that this alarmist narrative should have gained traction when it did. After the apparent escape from crisis in 2012, 2 years later, Europe found itself again at an impasse. To secure its functional viability, the Eurozone needed to make bold steps toward further integration. But in light of the mounting popular backlash and the ongoing economic uncertainty, where was the political momentum to come from? After the verdict delivered by Europe's voters in May 2014, who would want to risk a wave of referenda to ratify treaty change? Meanwhile, most of Europe outside the prosperous northern core was struggling to return to something like normal economic growth. Given time, would the German formula of austerity and reform work? Spain and Ireland were crawling their way back. But across much of southern Europe, the unemployment crisis was still acute. In 2014, the questions were getting ever louder. Would the mounting political backlash against the EU outrun Europe's halting economic recovery? Would that recovery even continue? By 2014, the risk of deflation was undeniable. The emerging markets on which Germany relied for its growth were faltering. If stagnation threatened, the political pressures would further escalate. Would the ECB be forced out of its defensive position into a more activist policy? As ever, the place where the tensions within the Eurozone were most acute was Greece. After 6 years of recession, the social crisis in Greece was manifest. In 2014, unemployment reached close to 27%. More than half of Greece's young people were out of work, and whereas they might once have drawn on their families for support, the main breadwinner all too often had lost his or her source of income too. By 2015, half of the population was relying on the pension income of a senior citizen to get by, an alarming statistic, given that half the pensions paid to senior citizens were below the poverty level. According to Eurostat, if the standard of poverty was anchored at the pre-crisis level, then almost half of the Greek population was at risk by 2015. The OECD reported that one in six was going hungry on a daily basis. In Athens, the homeless were everywhere. For those lucky enough to keep their jobs, real wages were down by 25%. At the same time, taxes had risen steeply. A nation of small property owners was furious at new land taxes. VAT, that bore most heavily on the poorest, was up from 13% to 24%. Contrary to popular belief, in northern Europe, the Greece welfare safety net was far from luxurious, and the health system was collapsing under the pressure of cuts. To escape the labour market crisis, since 2008, 400,000 Greeks had emigrated out of a population of 10 million. Those who left were predominantly well-educated young people, including tens of thousands of doctors. Not only was Greece experiencing a social crisis, but it was doing so at the behest of the Troika. Given that the majority of Greeks wanted very much to preserve their standing in Europe, first PASOK and then New Democracy had seen no option but to comply with the demands of the Troika creditors. But, not surprisingly, the crisis produced a broad-based mood of protest that was fueled by the desire for social solidarity and national self-assertion. On the right, the beneficiary was the racist Golden Dawn, a true neo-fascist movement. But by far, the more popular response was Syriza, the party of the radical left, which in the May 2014 European elections easily overtook the governing party, New Democracy. Realizing that its support was dwindling, Samaras's coalition government appealed to the EU and Berlin for concessions. If Greece could emulate Ireland and Portugal in making an early exit from its Troika program, it would be a great win for Europe and might give the Eurogroup's collaborators a chance at the polls. But Berlin waved the suggestion away. They had never trusted Samaras, and they were not about to make concessions. Hoping for a new mandate, Samaras called for elections. As was now commonplace, pro-austerity governments around Europe, as well as the IMF, chimed in. The Greek voters were left in no doubt that as far as Europe was concerned, New Democracy, PASOK, and the centrist Topotami party were the acceptable choices. Rajoy, Spain's conservative prime minister, campaigned for Samaras in Athens. Given the rise of Podemos, Spanish conservatives were desperate to avoid a left-wing victory. But on January 25, 2015, that is what the Greek voters delivered. Syriza, led by the youthful activist Alexis Tsipras, formed a government, and refuting the expectations of moderate social democrats in Berlin and Brussels, picked as its coalition partner not the centrist pro-European Topotami, but the ultra-nationalist Anel. Their views on religion and cultural values might not mesh, but Anel could be relied upon to go all the way in a confrontation with the EU. The confrontation would be tough. The challenge for Syriza was to force open the painful and unresolved question of Greek solvency. By buying out the private bondholders, the 2012 debt restructuring had removed market pressure from Athens. But given its declining economy, the Greek debt burden was still excessive. And by substituting public loans from the EU and the IMF for private debt, the 2012 deal had, if anything, raised the political stakes. It was one thing to burn private creditors who had gambled on high-yield Greek debt. It was quite another to suggest to conservative Northern Europe taxpayers that they should make further deep concessions to Greece's rebellious left-wing government. The result in 2015 was a renewed political confrontation, but one in which the fronts were dizzyingly inverted, or at least so they appeared in the rendering of the Greek situation offered by its new finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. An unorthodox leftist who had spent much of his career outside Greece in the Anglophone Academy, Varoufakis was never a Syriza insider. He had no